PETA Agri-Coatings for sponsoring that unforgettable luncheon. I'm glad a lot of people have stuck around for the last two sessions of the day. Hopefully you'll stick around for the happy hour afterwards, which includes hors d'oeuvres and cocktails, a roaming magician, a chance to win our grand prize. So come mingle with everybody one last time before you head home, head to Disney, head to play some more golf or whatever you're going to do. Glad you're going to stick around. Our next section is titled The Facts About Slime Mold and Fungi and Mulches, and will be presented by Kim Leonberger. Kim is an extension associate in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Kentucky's Martin Grattan College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. Kim attended Purdue University, where she obtained her B.S. in Horticultural Production and Marketing, B.S. in Agricultural Sales and Marketing, as well as her Master of Science degree in Plant Pathology. Today, Kim will educate us about mold and fungi and explain why it's not the mulch's fault. So, Kim, welcome to our annual meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so this is going to be a complete change from where we just were. I think I can probably say that I'm the only person to ever follow Rudy and talk about fungi. So, we have that. So, just a little bit of, introduction. So, I am a plant pathologist, which is probably something you never heard of. Plant pathologists help take care of plants when they're sick. So, most of the time I'm talking to people about plants that are infected with fungi, bacteria, or viruses. So this will be kind of fun because this is a little bit of a spin-off of that because everything that we're going to talk about today does not infect plants. So the title I was given, The Facts About Slime Molds and Fungi and Mulches. However, this might be something more consistent with what you would expect, right? From your perspective, right? The horrors that lurk within the mulch. It's spooky season, right? So understand that for you all, these organisms may look disgusting, gross, and trigger alarm, but for me, I say they're pretty cool. Fungi come in a lot of shapes, sizes, colors, and everything that we talk about today, along with everything that you see pictured here, is not a danger to living plants. So what are we going to do today? Well, my goal is to really answer two questions, and those are, what are these things in the mulch? And then, what do we do about them? And so hopefully today you'll be able to leave this session with some real-world answers, some suggestions about what you could offer to your clientele or maybe even use in your business practices, as well as some resources that are out there. So let's talk about what are fungi. So fungi are living microscopic organisms. We don't know exactly how many fungi exist in the environment, but the estimate is about 1.5 million different species of fungi. Now, the majority of those are not a harm. Most of the time, I spend my time talking about the 8,000 that are a problem to plants. Fungi are actually friends. They do need to get their nutrition from somewhere, and that's where they use their host. So they're going to use whatever they're growing on or whatever they've infected, and they're taking nutrients from that to be able to grow and reproduce. Now, when I say fungi, most of the time people will tell me that a fungi looks like a mushroom. And that is true. Mushrooms are part of fungi, but they're part of the reproductive cycle. So they're where they actually produce their offsprings. The actual body of a fungus are these thread-like structures called hyphae. We get a bunch of them together. They make mycelium. These are terms you may have heard before. So if you don't think you've ever met a fungus, you probably have. If you've ever left a strawberry in the refrigerator too long and it gets gray and fuzzy, right? That's a fungus. And that's what the body of a fungus actually looks like. So that's the organism itself. So fungi reproduce using spores, so all of these tiny structures. These are microscopic. Generally, we don't get to see these because they are so small. And they will create these spores oftentimes in certain structures, like mushrooms or other structures as well. And so obviously things like mushrooms are very visible to us, and so I think that's why we oftentimes associate fungi with mushrooms. Slime molds, however, are a very different ballgame. So While today I'm going to talk about both of them together, because in the sense of management, we can manage them very similarly, it's important to know that they're two very different types of organisms. Fungi are more closely related to animals, whereas slimmolds are not. They are single-celled organisms, they're amoeba-like, but they do also reproduce via spores. So because they're reproducing in the same way, our management goes along with that in the same way. So since we've all had mulch that hasn't had these before, the question begs, why do we sometimes have it and why do we sometimes not? So these organisms require three things to occur. So of course you have to have the organism itself, and then you need a food source, which in this case is our mulch. Okay? But the most important part of this that can be variable is the environment. So we need the right conditions. These organisms like to thrive in about 65 to 75 degrees, about 80 to 90% humidity, and they like it to be moist. They need those conditions to live and to reproduce. And if they don't have them, they don't do that. So environment is really important. And we're going to come back to this slide in a little bit, because this is going to be really important when we talk about management towards the end of the presentation. So as I mentioned, all of these organisms are saprophytes. Saprophytes or saprobes are organisms that decompose dead plant materials. So they are taking their nutrients from anything that's already dead, which is what mulch is. So that's why they're occurring there. Saprophytes do not infect healthy plant tissue. So it's important to know that these specific organisms are not a risk to any living tissue that's out there. So they do offer some benefits. They do break down that organic matter. And one of the other things that goes along with that is that they do improve soil nutrition and fertility because they're breaking down that dead organic material. However, when they start to look like this, clients get pretty upset, right? So most people, myself excluded, would say that these are very unsightly. They don't want them in their landscapes. They often create that alarm that they're going to move on to the living plants, especially in situations like this where it looks like this slime mold is actually climbing up the plant. It's not affecting the healthy tissue. It's just there's so much of it that it looks like it is. And the only other way that sometimes these can be a disadvantage is some mushrooms can be harmful to humans and animals. So it is important that if mushrooms are present in the landscape, not to consume them in any way unless you've had them properly identified first. So that's a little bit of kind of the introduction. So now I want to introduce you, if you haven't already, to some of the common ones that we get questions about in mulch. So the first one of these is stinkhorns. Stinkhorns, the body of this, are those hyphal threads that are in the mulch. So typically we don't actually see the body of the fungus until it gets to the reproductive stage. So the first thing that homeowners will often observe is an egg-like mass that eventually develops into these very characteristic-looking fungi or mushrooms. And as their name implies, they do oftentimes have a pretty disgusting smell. They do that because the spores or their offspring are spread by insects. And so that bad smell attracts the insects to come pick up their spores and then move them around. And like you'll see with everything that I'm going to talk about today, they like that warm and moist conditions, and that's where we see them develop. So things like shady areas, highly irrigated areas tend to have more of a problem with all of these. So the next one is puffballs. This one is one of my favorites just because of how they puff. But again, you don't see the actual body of it, so you're not going to know that they're there until they're in their reproductive phase. And so what will happen is you see the development of these ball-like structures. These can be very small, so we've seen them where they're, you know, less than an inch in diameter, all the way up to, you know, the giant ones look like a soccer ball, or bigger. So over time, these reproductive structures will mature, and once they are ready, then they will puff. And that's what you see in the bottom right-hand picture. We had found some puff balls, and we were able to tap them and get that cloud to come out. And that cloud is full of thousands of spores that are then blown by the wind out to cause additional, in your case, problems, my case, cool things. Spores can be released by touching, so if something's walking through there, it can also be dispersed by wind and water. So, and again, warm, moist conditions are what's going to lead to these. So getting into some of the ones that are oftentimes more common, bird's nest fungi get their name because that's what they look like. So again, you're not going to see the body of it. Typically, those threads are growing throughout the mulch, and we don't see them. So once their reproductive structures start to form, they grow up like a mushroom, but then they turn the other way to make a nest, and then they develop these spore masses inside. So these spore masses are then splashed from the nests into other parts of the landscape. They can go as high as about 2 feet, depending on how the water hits them. So again, warm, moist conditions. So, from what I hear, this is like your arch nemesis, artillery fungus. So, again, you're not going to see the body of it, but you might see the reproductive structures. Keep in mind that they are relatively small, and the issue with these is that their other name for artillery fungus is shotgun fungus. So the spores, or the spore masses, are forcefully ejected. So they just fly out of these structures. And those spore masses are small. They look like pepper flakes. They're black, and they're very sticky. And so they will stick to a lot of surfaces. So they can be extremely problematic for folks, because if the spores are released and they get on cars or on houses, they can be really challenging to remove. So one of the things that I do want to highlight is the difference between bird's nest fungi and artillery fungus. They can both occur together in the same mulch, in the same space. The bird's nest fungi will, in fact, take longer to form and then stick around longer. However, the artillery fungus are smaller, they dry out faster, and then they tend to go away. So a lot of times what will happen is folks will call us because they've got these little black things everywhere, and they'll go, I've got artillery fungus, what do? And then we come to find out that it's actually bird's nest fungus. So they can occur together, so it's important to recognize which one you have. One of the other ways that you can tell the difference is bird's nest fungi is pictured here on the leaf, whereas artillery fungus is pictured on the siding. So while both of them can stick to surfaces, bird's nest fungi can actually germinate. They're not going to infect. So you can see those little white threads coming out. That's the mycelium coming out of those structures. So they're germinating. They're not going to infect that tissue, but they're looking for the right food source. Whereas artillery fungi do not do that, and they just stick on there. Bird's nest fungi can be easily brushed off or scraped off, whereas artillery fungus is really adhered. You're going to have to use some elbow grease to get rid of that. So then we have slime molds. So slime molds are pretty disgusting looking, and their other name is dog vomit. I think it's an apical moniker for that. These really need moisture, and so we tend to see them pop up more commonly during periods of extended rain. So it's raining a lot, or it's raining very heavily. They first appear very slimy, and then over time, they become dried out, and they start to develop this powdery appearance. When they get to that stage, that's when they're going through their reproductive cycle, and that's when they're producing all of those spores that are going to be blown by wind or splashed by rainwater out into other spaces. So now that we've kind of talked about all these different organisms, and I've shared with you the biology behind them, let's ask the question, do we need to manage these? So sometimes these structures will appear quickly and dry up quickly, and they're not really a problem. They don't harm living tissue, which seems to at least be in my experience where consumers are the most concerned. They're worried that they're going to get onto their expensive landscape plants or onto their garden plants and cause issues, and that is not the case. And then it's important to note, again, these are serving a function. They are breaking down that material, that mulch, and restoring nutrients to the soil. So they are serving a benefit as well. But here's the hard truth about management. We don't know they're there until they are in their reproductive phase, which is problematic because our management strategies are most effective before they get there. But if you don't know you're going to have a problem, you have to be reactive. So again, that can be problematic. And then the other problem that we face is there's just not a lot of research being done. Research in this area is really important because research is where scientists have sat down, they've tried things, and they can say, based on experience, here's what we know works, and here's what we know doesn't, and this is how we can make a good recommendation that should be effective. And so we just don't have a lot of that. However, there are some strategies that can be used when it comes to managing these different groups. So coming back to this concept, we have the organism. These organisms are ubiquitous. They are everywhere, and we're not going to like just get rid of them because they just exist in nature everywhere. And of course, we're not getting rid of the food source because we need the mulch. It is good. It does a lot of service for plants and landscapes. And so those two things are going to be there. The one part of this that we can control is the environment. And so a lot of our management strategies are going to talk about how can we modify or change the environment to make it less favorable for these organisms to establish and reproduce. So we can group stinkhorns, puffballs, and bird's nest fungi together. And here's the strategies that I've put together. The first one, rake the mulch regularly. That improves airflow, so it allows it to dry out, it allows the air to move through it, and it helps keep it from being compacted. So that allows for those, again, that moisture to go away. It allows for all of that moisture to go away, all of that humidity to go down. So an important step, obviously it would be on a homeowner to do that. Manage irrigation. So if there's a lot of water, we know we're going to have more humidity, we know we're going to have more compaction, we know that that moisture is there, and that's going to favor the development of these. So making sure that it's irrigated for the plants, but not too wet. Remove these structures when they appear, certainly with stinkhorns and puffballs, because you're talking about removing one or two structures that are there. That is easier to do. Bird's nest fungi may be a little more challenging. They tend to produce more reproductive structures because they only have a few spore masses within each cup. The reason why we suggest that you remove these is if you see them early enough and you can remove them before those spores become mature, then they're not going out into the environment. And it helps to reduce the spread and distribution of these organisms, so it can kind of slow things down. And then certainly you can do things like covering with new mulch or replacing with mulch that would break down more slowly. And by that, I mean things that have bigger pieces, so they're not going to be as prone to decomposition as quickly. Now, with artillery fungus, this is where I'm going to spend most of my time because I know that this one is probably the hardest to manage. So prevention is your best bet. So don't get it in the first place. And these are very similar. Raking and managing irrigation, so both of the ones that we were doing before. There is evidence that shows that pine bark and pine straw, because those pieces are bigger and allow for more airflow, would be less prone to developing artillery fungi comparative to your hardwood fine mulches. You can try to cover these or replace them, but again, that may not necessarily help because if you get too much moisture and everything in there, you can really lead yourself to a problem. So I dug really deep on this specific group, and so I was able to find some additional research. So let me say that each one of these comes with some buts. So they sound all good when they're listed here, but there's a lot of information that's going to go along with that. So the first one is this idea of mixing mushroom compost with mulch to help suppress artillery fungi. So mushroom compost is when they produce mushrooms in mass, they have a substrate that they use that's been sterilized, and essentially once they're finished with it, you can use that and mix it with the mulch to be able to try to suppress artillery fungus. Now the group that did this research back in, I think this was 2005, found that if they used complete mushroom compost, so just tried to grow artillery fungus in mushroom compost, it completely suppressed the fungus. So then they tried to do a study where they were going to do it in the field and they were mixing at lower rates. So they mixed at 10%, 20%, and 40% mushroom compost into mulch. So that was the ratio. However, when they did that, their data was so variable that they really couldn't draw good conclusions. So when I put the word may in capital letters and underlined it, that was because it's a big if, right? It could, but we don't have anything specific to say what the right rate would be and how much suppression you would get. Another study looked at biological fungicides. So in this case, what they were trying to do was to take other biological organisms. So Trichoderma harzanium is a fungus, and Bacillus subtilis is a bacteria. So they were using these organisms to try to get rid of the artillery fungus. So when they took and put the biological fungicides on plates, so they did this in the lab, so when they did that, put them on the plates 14 days before they inoculated with the fungus, they had complete suppression. When both the biological fungicide and the fungus went on the plates at the same time, they had complete suppression. When they put the artillery fungus on first and then applied the biologicals, they had some suppression, but not 100%. So a few things to note with this study was, one, it was done in the laboratory. And what happens on petri plates is not necessarily applicable to a field setting. So there would need to be additional studies to look at these in the field to be able to say, does this work in real life, in the field, and at what rates do we need to be applying these, and how frequently? In addition to that, biological fungicides are labeled as our pesticides. And so if these were going to be used in mulch for the treatment of artillery fungus, they would have to be labeled as such. Using them in that manner without it being on the label is a violation of federal law. So that is another limitation of that study. So the last study that I found actually compared 26 fungicides, conventional fungicides, against artillery fungus, and found that there were some that seemed to provide control. However, again, this was a laboratory study, and the authors of the paper specifically stated at the end that you would need to have a field study before you could make a recommendation. So two things to note here. Again, with that one, you're going to also require label changes that don't, you know, would take time. So it's not something that would be a tomorrow kind of solution, even if the research was done in the field. So all of these studies were done between 2001 and 2009. So this was a while ago. So again, this just really points to the knowledge gap that we have in this area. That's not an area that anyone that I know of or others that I've consulted know of are working on. But with artillery fungi, if you get them and they do eject the spores and they stick to things, I could not find any specific recommendations that were supported by research, but here's what the general consensus in our community is, which is that early removal results in the best results. So if you see them coming on early, you can typically get them off easier, and you result in fewer stains, because even once you take the spores off, if they've been there for a while, you can still end up with stains on the siding. Or even on a car. Power washing is an option, but again, you have to know where that's appropriate. You wouldn't want to do that on a brick house. You wouldn't want to do that to someone's car. So scrubbing with soapy water or a cleaner, again, there have been some studies that looked at different products, but nobody's come to a consensus or a specific recommendation about what cleaners or solvents would be best to try to remove these. But again, there does seem to be this consensus that if you can soak the space, that it does kind of let those spores loosen, and then they're easier to remove. They can then at that point kind of be scraped off with a putty knife, whether that be plastic or metal, depending on what type of surface you're dealing with. So with slime molds, management is similar. You can just allow them to dry out. I mentioned when they first appear, they tend to be really slimy looking, like these. So over time, they will develop that dry, powdery appearance, and then eventually they'll just go away once they don't have enough moisture. So they can just kind of disappear over time. Again, because these do have such a reliance on water, managing irrigation would be important. And then you can also rake to break them up, but then also allow for that airflow and manage that moisture. So the other thing that you can do with slime molds is you can, again, cover them with new mulch or replace with a mulch that's kind of a bigger, chunkier pieces. If you are going to try to dig it out, my recommendation to you is this. With slime molds, because they get that powdery growth, and then once you disturb them, they're just essentially spreading spores everywhere, is before you try to remove them, is to take a piece of newspaper or something else, wet it down, put it on top of it, so that then when you go underneath it to try to dig it out and remove it, you're not spreading all those spores and potentially creating more of an issue. So that brings me to what can you do? This is kind of my summary slide. So one of the options that you do have is to help educate consumers about the benefits that these organisms provide. They do have their function. If they're breaking down more mulch, or if they're breaking down mulch, then your customers probably need more mulch. So there's that. You can also recommend these cultural practices, so things like raking and irrigation management. I know I've talked a lot about how to help clients, but if you are running a large operation, you see these popping up in your mulch piles, in your operations, making sure that you're turning those, that you go to smaller piles, that can help reduce the humidity, making sure that when you're bagging mulch, make sure that it's dry first. Don't trap all that moisture in there with it. You don't want your customer getting a bag of mulch with the fungi already growing in it. If you have had, or if there's a space that you just know that there's been an artillery fungus time and time again, maybe making that recommendation to someone to go to larger piece mulch, something like the pine straw bark, or the pine straw or the pine barks nuggets. And then referring clients to the extension service. So the extension service is something that I'm a part of and something I'm very passionate about. The cooperative extension service exists all across the United States. It's typically associated with the land grant institution in each state. In Kentucky, it's a collaboration between the University of Kentucky and Kentucky State University. So the extension service is oftentimes free or at minimal cost to clients. In Kentucky, our taxpayers contribute money to our extension service, and so our agents are in every county, and they will help clients with questions like this, so it can kind of take one thing off your plate. There are obviously university publications and research. While there is a lack of research in this area, there is some out there, but there are publications by other universities related to that, so you may be able to find something that's specific for your state or connect with someone at a university who can provide you with additional information. At University of Kentucky, we have a publication that we developed because we got a lot of questions about these, and so this publication is called Mulch, Mushrooms, Slime Molds, and Other Saprophytes, and it essentially details everything that I've already talked about with you all today, and actually is, I think, the reason why I'm here. So it's a great publication. It has lots of photos in it, so it is available on our website. So if you Google search UKY Plant Pathology, it'll take you there. You can go to our extension publications and find this. You can download it for free, and you can distribute it at your leisure. And then I work for Dr. Nicole Gauthier. I help support all of her extension programs. And so we do have a YouTube channel that is under her name, and we provide a lot of resources there. And now that I've given this presentation to all of you, expect that there will be a version of this available there. So if you have customers who are concerned and you want to give them a video to watch, that should be there in the next couple of months. So with that, thank you to Tom and Shelley for inviting me. I know this probably wasn't as exciting as Rudy, but hopefully you learned a few things about mushrooms and fungi. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that anybody has. I can, yeah. Sure. And I can also repeat questions. So yeah, you're going to want to try to go as low as you can, so kind of trace it back to the ground level and then break that off. So the fungi are still there because they've still got that those hyphal threads that are going to move throughout the mulch, but you're eliminating the reproductive structures, and at that point we've found that most of the time consumers are pretty good with that.
Kim, she doesn't pick them, I do.
Okay. It's all right. You ask your significant other to go out with gloves and remove them for you. That's the right answer. I had a question over here.
I thought I read at some point, but maybe I dreamed it, that arthropod fungus prefers like certain direction, like northern light or southern light.
Not that I found. So we tend to find it in specific areas that tend to be more shady. So it kind of depends on more from my understanding and from what I've read on, you know, how is the house oriented? Does it cast shade? So we might see it in certain cardinal directions based off of how other things are located in the landscape and where the shade's being cast, where the low spots are, those types of things.
Are any of these fungi poisonous to animals?
So none of the ones that we talked about today are. There can be, I would imagine that most animals are not going to mess with a stinkhorn because they really stink. They tend to smell like rotten meat or rotten milk, so they're pretty gross. If animals or humans, because sometimes we do have children eat mushrooms, not knowing that they're going to make that decision that day, generally these are not poisonous in a sense that they are going to require a hospital visit or result in death, but they can make you pretty sick. So something more like food poisoning where you get very ill and you might have to go to the hospital because you get dehydrated, but not something where it's so toxic that it's going to kill you. So,
when we first started getting calls about artillery fungus, and when the UPenn was doing its first research, it tended to be most in the Northeast, New England area, but it had spread slowly.
So I know that we get all of these in Kentucky. A lot of it depends on I think the movement of products as well as like just people moving things has helped to spread it. I will say that I think it is more common in cooler climates because once we get into like really hot temperatures, it's not necessarily super happy. It doesn't like it 100 degrees outside. So I don't know the specific, like I couldn't say it goes to this state, but I think I would say it's probably spread definitely throughout the Midwest and probably as far south as Kentucky and Tennessee. It may have gone further than that, though. So for these, they can survive for quite a while, several months to a year, depending on the species. So they can hang out for quite a while. They can. Heat specifically can. Cold typically does not. Most of them are pretty immune to those types of things. But heat, you're talking And again, it varies depending on the specific fungus or slime mold. And I would say you're looking at least 170 to 200 degrees. So pretty hot, hotter than you're going to be able to get like in a small pile in your yard or something like that. Saw another hand. Yeah.
I've been learning about compost and thought that real healthy plants require healthy fungi. Have you found that in your research? Whether it's gardens or landscapes or grass?
So we know that there are many types of fungi that are beneficial that reside in our soils, in our forests, and they don't cause harm to plants. They're feeding off of something else. So in this case, these would be considered more helpful fungi, these decomposers, than saprophytes, because they're going to break down any leaf material. We will see them pop up occasionally in yards that are very, or on golf courses, where you have very heavily managed spaces and you're building up like a big thatch layer, so where all that cut grass is building up inside of the grass. So it just needs that dead organic material. But yeah, fungi can be very beneficial and they offer a lot of advantages. So they're not necessarily something you want to remove from an ecosystem. They're pretty critical. So another hand. Yep.
Is there any research on the potential or known impact of biostimulants?
Not that I'm aware of. Any other questions?
Other questions? Well, thank you, Kim. Thank you. Very fascinating and informative.
And I will be here during the break and then during the reception this evening. So if you have other questions or think of other things you want to discuss, feel free to touch base.
Who knew molten fungi could be so exciting?
I
love
right?
it.
Perfect.
Thank you, Kim, very much.
Thank you.
Our final break of the day is sponsored by Chromescape. It'll run from 3 to 3:30. Then we'll finish strong back here at 3:30 with our Colored Mulch Insights panel.
Thank you.